Now, from Mayo Clinic, it's Medical Edge Weekend, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. Plus, we'll take you beyond the headlines for in-depth discussions of what developments in medicine mean to you. Information you want from specialists who know. Join the conversation by phone, through our blog, or on Twitter by going to radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. More and more patients in this country are being urged by their doctors and their friends and their family and the lay press and politicians to take a more active role in their healthcare decisions. Now, the way it's always been is that the doctor is almost always the decider. He's sort of God.
And or she.
Or she, exactly. And they make most of the healthcare decisions for the patients without a lot of input from the patients or from their families. And that's just traditional medicine.
And the way it's been.
Right. But maybe that's not the best way. Maybe the patient ought to be more involved in what's done to them and for them. And if and when that happens, there's a name for it, as you might suspect, and it is called shared decision making.
Yes. Today on Medical Edge Radio, we'll meet the director of the Healthcare Delivery Research Program at Mayo, and, as you can imagine, a very strong proponent of shared decision-making, Dr. Victor Montori. We'll find out why shared decision-making just might be a good idea, at least for some patients. It's a good place to start. And we'll ask Dr. Montori if patients are becoming more involved in their care, and if they're not, how they can be. Plus, we'll talk about another concept called minimally disruptive medicine. In fact, that's the last time he was here, that's what we talked about.
Right. And minimally disruptive medicine has to do with the same good treatment that we all try to give, but it's done with fewer doctor visits and fewer medications and fewer complicated instructions. And all that we're going to talk about when we meet today's guest, Dr. Victor Montori.
But first, this past week, the FDA announced a proposal that would require indoor tanning beds to carry prominent warning labels indicating that children younger than 18 should not use them, and that people who do use them need to be getting regular cancer screening. Joining us to discuss the proposal, Mayo Clinic dermatologist Dr. Don Davis. Good morning, Dr. Davis.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Tracy. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
No, of course. My pleasure.
Were you surprised? I'm sure pleasantly surprised, but were you surprised by this proposal of the FDA?
I think my whole department was jumping up and down with joy. We've been working so hard on a state and national level as dermatologists to have tanning beds banned, much less have label warnings. So this is the first step towards victory for public health.
So you're saying that you'd like to see tanning beds banned?
Yes, we would like to ban tanning beds altogether.
I have to say that I was surprised that there isn't already a warning label. I guess that's good news. That means I don't go to tanning beds, so I didn't know that. But
I'm glad you didn't know because you didn't go. But tanning beds are right now classified as a class one medical device, which is the same as a Band-Aid or a tongue depressor or a gauze pad, meaning that they have no risk, which we know is not true because people who use tanning beds have a 75% increased risk of melanoma over their lifetime, which is tremendous because the incidence of melanoma is rising anyway.
Well, what do people... Okay, so 75% increase, but what do they need to understand? Because they are sold as being a healthy alternative to the sun.
Sure. So you can get vitamin D other ways, such as by dietary supplementation and multivitamins. You only need about 10 minutes of casual sun exposure, which means things that are usually not clothed when you walk around on the street, such as your face, your neck, and the backs of your hands. You need about 10 minutes of light exposure to those areas about once a week to get enough vitamin D naturally from the sun. So going to a tanning bed is obviously overkill. No one needs that much ultraviolet light exposure, and it's very dangerous.
On your car drive and your walk across the parking lot to get to the tanning salon, you've gotten the vitamin D that you need.
That's exactly right. If you look at all of those health exercise things where they tell you to park at the back of the parking lot when you go shopping, if you park at the back of the parking lot, you'll protect your car, you'll get enough vitamin D, and you'll get some exercise.
Hey, what about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? I mean, this is America. You got that label on the cigarette package that scares me to death, and now I go to the scanning booth and you got some label on there. I mean, what do you say to those people?
Well,
I mean, it's personal choice.
It is a matter of personal choice, but you should be educated about the choice that you're making.
You think that ultimately tanning beds will be banned? I mean, are you guys strong enough, you skin doctors? Really?
That is a goal. We have big muscles, and we have a lot of brain power behind it. We're trying to collect as much data as we can to prove to the Congress that they need to be eliminated. But having them forbidden for minors is the first step. Having a warning about their risk is the second step. And then encouraging that people who use a tanning bed should get annual skin cancer exams is a third step in the right direction.
Well, you know, but Dr. Montori and I still want to look good at the prom. And, you know, you sort of like the spray-on tan, though, don't you? Doesn't that look just about as good?
Yes. Well, good luck to you and Dr. Montori for looking good for the prom.
We can't get a date, but we're going.
But we prefer in dermatology to use sunless tanner, which you can either do in a spray application or you can apply yourself. And about 15 years ago, those were all atrocious shades of orange, but now they come in all sorts of shades of beige and brown and black to address people of all skin types and all ethnicities, and they're very easy to apply. They last for about a week. The chemical is safe to the skin because it soaks into the top dead layers, and then it naturally sheds with time.
You're sure that you're not going to find out in a couple of years that that causes cancer?
We don't think so. We've done a lot of literature searching on dihydroxyacetone, and it seems to be quite safe.
I think it's a good place to start, though, this warning label on the bed itself, because every year the number of, I mean, I know we're talking about teenage girls going to the prom here, but women that are my age, younger and older, who say, oh, I got to go get some tan before I go on vacation.
That's right. What you really need to do is wear a higher number sunscreen the first couple of days you go on vacation to prepare your skin for the increased dose of sunlight. And let's be frank, a lot of the times the reason that minors use tanning beds is because it's cheap babysitting. The mom or dad goes in because dad's tan too, mom's tan, grandma's tan, you know, and it's much easier to put your child in the tanning bed next to you for the 15 minutes that you're in the tanning bed than it is to arrange daycare or childcare for your child.
Wow.
Now, there is no question in your mind that use of a tanning bed or too much sun causes skin cancer.
There is no doubt that increased ultraviolet light exposure over time causes an increased risk of basal cell carcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, and malignant melanoma. And melanoma all three skin cancers are serious, but malignant melanoma is lethal in 30% of people who get the disease.
Now, let's talk about the mole who gets the mole, because you are part of that cartoon PSA now that Mayo Clinic has put out. And I put a link to it on our webpage. So if you haven't seen it, it's radio.mayoclinic.org. But you are one of the people who helped provide the intellectual property for that.
That's right. Dr. Jerry Brewer and I created a public service announcement with the help of our colleagues in marketing to promote to children and adolescents the dangers of sun exposure and not using photoprotective measures like sunscreen, clothing, and umbrellas. And I would highly encourage everybody to see our cute commercial about the mole who gets the mole and how he gets fried.
Yeah, he turns into a lobster. He gets such a bad sunburn at the beach. It's
That's
so
right.
cute.
And we have a very lovely Jamaican song about, you know, out sunning all day and how we got a sunburn swimming all day.
Again, that's at radio.mayoclinic.org, and hopefully it's going to be on the screen at Target Field. I understand that's one of the places where it's heading, because hello, you're in the sunshine when you're at Target Field.
That's right.
All right. Well, Dr. Davis, thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure.
All right. Good to talk to you, Dawn.
Bye-bye.
All right. We'll take a short break, but coming up, we'll talk with the director of the Healthcare Delivery Research Program at the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Victor Montori. Plus, myth or matter of fact, 80% of adults go online to find health information. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up.
Did you go online to find that fact? Is that what you did?
Yeah, I certainly did.
Right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for Dr. Montori at 507-282-1234. Also go to that website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or tweet us anytime at #MayoRadio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio. Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae, and this week's guest, Dr. Victor Montori. He is Director of Healthcare Delivery Research Program at the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Montori, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
It's great to be here.
All right, so what's it all about? Shared decision making, a new term to most of us. What are you really talking about, and what are you trying to accomplish?
When patients go to the clinic to see a doctor and make decisions with their doctor, they're really flipping coins. There's a lot of chance in those situations. And hopefully when you go and get care and you flip a coin, the coin will be biased towards getting more benefit than harm. But in many situations, there's more than one coin to flip. There's more than one sensible way to proceed. And those sensible ways to proceed may be different to different people, may feel different to different people, may have different downsides, different costs, different harms, different adverse effects that different people will value differently. Right now, in many cases, the doctor tries to figure out what kind of patient they're in front and tries to figure out which of those will be better and makes a recommendation. Oftentimes, the patient goes with that. That's changing by virtue of having now many more options and much more information about those options, such that now people can, I think, reasonably look at those options and participate with their doctor in deciding which one is best for them.
All right, but here's the problem. We are all being asked to see more and more patients, which means that you're spending less and less time with every patient. How is it that this concept, you can implement this concept in a limited amount of time?
I am very unreasonable about it. In other words, when somebody tells me that they are asking us to see more patients, I think the fundamental question is who is they and what are their motivations to make us do that? I think that if we have enough adequate time to engage with our patients in a number of different ways, not necessarily face-to-face during a long consultation, but that actually turns out to be a good way of doing it for important decisions. If we can actually have those conversations, we may not need to see each other so often. And there may be ways of making it fit. But I think fundamentally we need to decide what is healthcare about. And I think it's about patients and not about seeing many of them, but taking care of them.
All right. Now, Tom just came at it from the physician angle, and I'll come at it from the patient angle. So some patients will come with the mindset that the doctor knows what the doctor knows, and I don't know anything, and I don't want to have the responsibility of knowing anything. I just want the doctor to tell me what they think is best, and that's what I'm going to do. And you are asking patients also to step up to the plate and change their behavior, which is what?
Well, so the traditional patient would basically assume the doctor knows best and go with the recommendation. But again, I think the recognition that there are many ways of skinning the cat that are acceptable and that they will be feel different to different people, I think should motivate patients to wonder whether there is more than one way than the way that is being recommended to them.
As before, when we were getting ready to come in here, you were talking about a patient who, through an experience that she went through with her spouse, it affected what she wanted for her health care. Mm-hmm. So patients do come with all of these different, you know, my dad had a heart attack, I saw how terrible that was, and I don't want... So every patient has a different playing field from where they come from.
Yeah, I think we need to recognize that when we want to make decisions, we want to make decisions based on high quality information. And one of the sources of information is our personal experience with ourselves, with our friends and family, with our own body. And in getting that experience, in getting that information, that information is valuable. And it interferes or supports our decisions. So if my doctor tells me, do this, and I go home and I say, I don't really trust medicines. And I leave that prescription sitting. I don't take it. I just wasted all sorts of time and effort instead of trying to get the treatment that fits my values and preferences.
But that's very true for a fair number of chronic conditions. For example, high blood pressure. There's a huge one where you can sit down and you can talk about the risks of letting your blood pressure get out of control and staying out of control and give them a prescription for an antihypertensive, and people don't take it. And they don't take it because they feel fine. So how do you solve that problem? Are you telling me that if you and the patient interact in a more intimate way, that they're going to understand that they have to take this medication and they will?
I think that the experience that we've had over the last 10 years is to show patients what is it that we know, but not necessarily in terms of fear, creation of fear, or by telling them that their blood pressure is important. Nobody cares. I don't feel my blood pressure. People don't feel their blood pressure.
Right.
But if you are 75 years old and you love your independence and you want to live in your house and you want to be able to do what you want to do, you should be very afraid of a stroke. Well, the major risk factor for a stroke is high blood pressure. Let's control that, reduce your risk of stroke so you can live independently in your house. Now you care.
There's a great variation among patients with regard to what they understand, what they know about their own condition. So some patients, it's relatively easy to interact and share in the decision making. Some patients, it's not. So I would say that although this is a great idea and a great concept, for some patients, it's not the right thing. It's not the best thing. Would you agree?
No. I think that about 99% of people will want to receive information about the available options from their health professional. It is the task of the health professional to make themselves understandable. We have a technical term for when patients don't understand it, and say they're patients with low literacy. And when you talk to patients about that, they'll say, no, I have a patient with low, I have my doctors have low clarity. And so I think we have to work harder on the clarity and stop blaming the patients for having less education than what we want.
A change that the physicians, the medical institution needs to make, and the patients need to make, and the families that support the patients that need to make.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a big, I don't think it's an enormous, I don't think it's a big ask. When somebody's suffering, though, they may be less interested in taking responsibility for making decisions. And this is where caring is important and empathy is important. A health professional can engage with the patient in advance, where they give as much opportunity for patients to participate and patients take as much opportunity as they can. But there is a dance, and we don't want clinicians, doctors, to abandon the patient and say, you know, it's your decision, because when you're suffering and you're confused, you don't want to be left alone to make tough choices.
What does the Affordable Care Act, depending on your politics, Obamacare, whatever you want to call it, how does that play into this now? Does the Affordable Care Act encourage people to be part of this?
The legislation included language that supports developing tools and skills and policies for shared decision making. But I think there is an underlying tone to it, which is that if we have the opportunity to engage patients in decision making, that they will choose treatments that will be less expensive, and that will help reduce the overall cost of healthcare. This is exactly the wrong motivation to do this. We need to do this because it's the right of patients to get the treatments that they would choose to get if they knew what we know.
Mm-hmm.
Not everything, if what follows is less invasive care, less aggressive care, less expensive care, that's a good side effect of it. But that should not be the primary motivation.
Hmm. If I'm a patient and my doctor has always pretty much told me the way things are and what I ought to do, and I want to change that, I want to change the interaction, I want to be part of the decision-making process, how do I let my doctor know that? And how do I get them to understand that we need to talk more and I want to be part of this, of what's done for me or to me?
I think that there are three questions that you can rehearse and practice and come prepared to when you come to see us. One is, okay, what are my options? The second one is, what are the pros and cons of those options? And the third one, which most people forget to ask, is how likely are those?
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, you may be told that if you don't do this, you know, I'm a diabetes doctor, and sometimes we have a shorthand where we say, well, if you don't take your insulin, you're going to lose your eyes, your kidneys, your legs. Well, the truth is, the likelihood that you will go blind, lose your kidneys, or lose your legs is very low. So I think clarifying those, so what are my options, what are the pros and cons, and the likelihoods of those in a way that patients can understand is the job of the clinician. Asking those questions could be the job of the patient.
All right, so say that again. The important things to ask your doctor if you want to be part of this shared decision-making process are, what are my options, what are the pros and cons of those options, and how likely are those complications?
Yeah, those pros and cons, the upsides and the downsides.
Because we are getting, you guys, the medical, you are getting better at diagnosing things, finding things. You know, we were talking beforehand about thyroid issues. You know, sometimes patients will die and then you find out, oh, look at that, he had prostate cancer and we didn't even know. Oh, she had breast cancer, we didn't even know. They die of something else. So we are getting better at diagnosing and making patients of more people, too.
Yeah, and I think by doing that at an earlier stage, there are more options available to them, include observation or aggressive treatment. And I think the opportunity for patients to understand that those are reasonable, sensible options and they should feel fine pursuing them is part of the challenge of shared decision-making.
Watchful waiting.
Yeah, well, that's a terrible term, right? Because that suggests that you become anxious and worried as a healthy living with a condition is a particularly challenging task, and everyone out there that has a chronic disease knows what I'm talking about.
Obviously, this is a complete paradigm shift, as they say, and there are some barriers to making this happen. What are those? What are the most difficult obstacles that prevent shared decision-making from being a reality?
The first one is, I think, the willingness of the parties, you know, the patients and the clinicians, to engage in the conversation. The second one is the recognition that there is more than one, that a decision is being made and that there is more than one way of doing it. Sometimes that is not recognized, and so the opportunity for shared decision-making comes and goes without the parties realizing them. The third one, which is in the literature, in the medical literature, but can be overcome with adequate design, is time. You mentioned it before, but I think we have developed tools over the last 10 years that allow patients and clinicians to have very sophisticated decision-making that only adds 2 to 3 minutes to a regular consultation.
All right. So the important things, if you want to participate in this and participate with your own physician regarding the medical decisions that are made for your care.
Right.
The three questions are, what are my options? What are the pros and cons of those options? And how likely are these things to happen, right?
Yep.
I would suggest maybe they should bring in, you know, like a basket of cookies or something when they say, Doc, I've got a change that I want to make, because that sometimes might not go over very well.
I think that if your clinician reacts negative to that invitation, you should probably change doctors.
All right, get a new doctor if that doesn't work. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio. Our guest is Dr. Victor Montori. Coming up, this week's Health and Medical News with our friend Vivian Williams. And right after that, your phone calls, 507-282-1234. Let us know what you think about shared decision making. Your comments and questions from our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, and your tweets at #radio. This is Medical Edge Radio.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with a look at health and medical news. If the symptoms of perimenopause and menopause aren't annoying enough, here's news about how some of those symptoms, insomnia and sleep disturbances, can be bad for a woman's health. Research shows those issues may increase the risk of coronary heart disease and cardiovascular disease. Turns out, data shows a combo of altered sleep duration and insomnia among women ages 50 to 79 doubled their risk over a period of more than 10 years. The study was published in the Journal of Women's Health. If you have problems sleeping, talk to your healthcare provider about ways to get better shut-eye. And now, the FDA wants to send a stronger message that tanning beds are bad for your health. The federal agency issued a new statement aimed at making manufacturers test and certify the ultraviolet light machine's design and performance. The FDA also wants to put warning labels on all tanning beds, recommending that they not be used by those under 18 and that all users get regular screening exams for skin cancer. Mayo Clinic pediatric dermatologist Dr. Don Davis calls that proposal a huge victory for public health.
Anyone who uses a tanning bed has an increased risk of melanoma, a 75% increase. That is very substantial because melanoma is on the rise, and it is a common and potentially lethal or deadly skin cancer.
And now let's switch gears to talk about air pollution and your health. High levels of air pollution are not just bad for your lungs, they may also increase a child's risk of insulin resistance, which is a precursor to diabetes. Air pollution comes in different forms, but the researchers say all kinds are potential oxidizers, which affect lipids and proteins in the body. Stress caused by this could play a role in the development of insulin resistance. Researchers say there's also evidence that air pollution is associated with lower birth weight and growth restrictions, which are known risk factors for type 2 diabetes. More research needs to be done to figure it all out, but they say results support the idea that the development of diabetes in adults might have its origin in early life, including environmental exposures. The research from Germany is published in the Journal of the European Association for the Study of Diabetes. And finally, there are many benefits to having a pet. They're cute and can keep you company. And now research shows having a pet might lower your risk of heart disease. That's according to info from the American Heart Association published in the journal Circulation. They say pet ownership, particularly dog ownership, may reduce heart disease risk factors, but they're not exactly sure why. Could be that healthier people are the ones who have pets, and dog owners may be healthier because they get exercise when they play or walk. Researchers say you shouldn't go get a dog or a pet just to reduce your risk of heart disease because they don't know all the answers. And that's a look at health and medical news. I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio. Information you want from specialists who know, on air, online. And don't forget, you can always pick us up on iHeartRadio on your smartphone. Time for you to join our conversation. We are talking about shared decision making with the Director of Healthcare Delivery Research Program at Mayo, Dr. Victor Montori. Our telephone number, 507-282-1234. Or you can always leave a comment or question at our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Or you can tweet us at hashtag Mayo Radio. We'll get back with Dr. Montori in just a moment. But first, I want to talk about a major shift, a huge event this week. The American Urological Association has pulled back from its strong support of prostate cancer screening, the PSA blood test. They now say that instead of testing everybody every year, testing should be considered only for men between the ages of 50 and 69. Joining us by telephone, Mayo urologist Dr. Matthew Getman. Dr. Getman, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks so much, Tom.
Now, I know that you have just returned from the big national meeting of the American Urological Association, and I suspect this was a big topic of conversation.
Well, it sure was. I mean, I think that all members of the AUA are really concerned about the diagnosis of prostate cancer, but we need to be sure that we're not over-diagnosing or over-treating this disease.
This sounds just like shared decision-making that we've been talking about.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And because, and you're saying that because sometimes the treatment is worse than the disease, right?
That could potentially be the case. I mean, we've shown very clearly that with prostate cancer screening, we've reduced mortality. But we also know that one in four men that are newly diagnosed with prostate cancer may have a low-grade kind of
indolent.
That's not going to indolent cancer, not going to cause a problem.
Wasn't there also a story this week that suggested that there's now a way to tell which are the bad ones and which aren't?
There is, but that requires patients undergoing a prostate biopsy to be able to use that tissue that's removed and then determine if the patient has a high-risk or low-risk disease.
Is that the direction that the treatment and the diagnosis of prostate cancer, is that a direction that it's going?
It's a rapidly changing field. Ultimately, I think we would be better if we developed new blood tests because having a patient undergo a biopsy is so invasive and is one of the reasons that AUA has pulled back on the recommendations for screening.
So we'll be able to tell that through a blood test very soon.
I hope that would happen down the road. Right now, that's not available. We still have to rely on PSA.
All right, you think a breast biopsy is bad. You know, a prostate biopsy is no fun at all, I'm sure. Fortunately, I have not had one.
But you're right. Yeah, that's right.
If we had a blood test instead of having to do that biopsy, that would certainly be helpful. Well, now tell us exactly how the guidelines, these new guidelines, are different than the old.
Well, we started at age 40 with the old guidelines. Now we'll really start focusing on an age 55 through 69 to discuss prostate cancer screening. And again, it's shared decision-making. We really have to talk about the pros and the benefits with the individual patients. If patients decide to do this, the interval increases from annual screening to every two-year screening. And if patients have low PSAs, let's say starting at age 60, then that interval of testing can actually be increased every 4 years.
And then what you're saying with a cutoff at age 69 is that after age 69 or 70, it's unlikely that even if you have prostate cancer that it's going to kill you?
Well, that's not necessarily true. And I think you really at that point have to assess what is the patient's long-term survival. And there are going to be patients after age 70 that will still be candidates for screening. And we also know that there can be high-risk prostate cancer that's diagnosed in men greater than age 70. So for some men, screening will still go on, but the threshold for biopsy will change. The new recommendation would suggest you wouldn't do a biopsy unless the PSA were greater than 10 in a man that were age 70 or older.
So you're not abandoning the PSA blood test. You're just changing the guidelines about who should get it and when and how often.
We just want to be smarter. The whole AUA guideline was developed now based upon the evidence that we have in comparison to expert opinion.
All right. And you, I presume, are all for this?
You know, I think we have to really be responsible. And I think all urologists are very concerned about overdiagnosis and overtreatment.
Yeah, because as we know, the complications of prostate surgery, if you have your prostate out, even if the robot does it, you got to worry about incontinence and impotence, right?
Absolutely. And when men hear they have a diagnosis, currently 90% will opt to have treatment.
Wow. And what is the incidence of incontinence and impotence following prostatectomy?
Well, I mean, it really relies on who's doing the operation, but for a high-volume surgeon, the chance of incontinence would really be less than 5%. The chance of impotence would range anywhere from 20 to 30%.
I want to go back to what you said, though, and actually, Dr. Montori, if you want to come in on this conversation, we can just bring you in here, too, but it's interesting that even when you explain the side effects from the surgery, American patients, I just think that's kind of an American thing. Like, I have cancer, we got to get it out of me. But what you are saying is that you can actually, we could leave that there, and it actually might not end up bothering you as much as you think. Having, I have cancer inside of me might bother you.
Yeah, I mean, that's where it becomes a very personal decision as to what you want to do. And that's the reason why, you know, I think the onus is on urologists to really be good educators about this disease.
Isn't that asking a lot of a patient, Dr. Montori, to say, yeah, I'm okay with leaving cancer in me for a while?
I think the main issue here is when Matt says that it's up to the urologist to teach the patients what it is about. I think there are some language challenges that
sure.
he has. When he tells a patient they have cancer, all these emotional issues that you're raising are going to come up. What if we change the name of this condition? There's been some efforts to actually change the name of some of these indolent lesions, get rid of the word cancer, and then open up the lines of conversation about options.
All right,
and
now,
then also, those patients that decide on active surveillance, you know, we continue to check them with PSA and follow-up biopsies. So we don't just rely on one data point.
All right, that's good. And now, after listening to this program, and there are a lot of people who do.
Everyone does.
That's right.
That I know.
Your patients are going to come in there and going to ask you three questions. They're going to say, what are my options? What are the pros and cons? And how likely are those things to happen? Dr. Getman, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, you bet. Appreciate it.
I love how this all ends up working up. This happens during the week that we have Dr. Montori scheduled, and I'm going to be in trouble if I don't ask you the myth or matter of fact question. Dr. Montori, myth or matter of fact, 80% of adults go online to find health information. Do you suppose that's true or false?
Yeah, it is true, and it's at least 80%.
At least.
Good thing?
Excellent thing. I think that patients recognizing the conversation we just had, how do you prepare yourself for conversations about important issues? How do you prepare yourself when you buy a car or when you make other important purchase decisions? You actually research it. I think researching your health condition online is a great behavior, and you just have to be mindful about the quality of those resources may be different.
Exactly. And there's no question that there's a huge difference in the quality of the information that's out there. Some of it's very good. Some of it's not very good at all. And we run into that not infrequently. Someone will find out what their diagnosis is, and they'll go on the internet, and they swear when they come in that it's hardly worth coming because they're going to die. But they don't really understand the pros and cons, the options, and the true prognosis. Because some of the stuff out there is totally wrong.
Yeah, this is not only a problem for patients. This is also a problem for physicians. Many physicians go online to their own resources to actually get health information without recognizing that that information is corrupt. And it's modified to meet particular commercial needs of somebody that's selling a device or a product. So everybody in healthcare is at risk of getting information that is not truthful or accurate or helpful. Dr. Getman just told us that the American Urologic Association went from expert opinion to evidence from research to change their guidelines. Well, that's fantastic. That means that the expert opinion was different from what the research showed, and they were able to go with that for a long time. So we have to be welcoming of that fundamental change.
And if you stay on the internet long enough, you would swear you have to go home and cleanse your colon after the program.
That's where it's all at.
Nothing's further from
that. That hasn't happened to me yet.
If you have a question, give us a call, 507-282-1234, or you can send us a tweet. Audrey, our producer, is monitoring those tweets at hashtag Mayo Radio. For instance, she said, I go online for information, but only to Mayo's site.
There you go.
So we got
MayoClinic.com.
MayoClinic.com.
That's good stuff.
I have to say, the next tweet that came through was, I do go online, but then I regret it every time. And I can see that mindset also, because you end up finding so much conflicting information when you go online that it's confusing.
I think being alone in a confusing world is very difficult, and having a partner in your clinician, in your health professional that can help you through that journey makes a huge difference.
507-282-1234. Janice is on the line. Good morning, Janice. Welcome to Medical Edge Radio.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Actually, I have two questions. How do you manage patients that don't want to make the decision? They say, just tell me what to do and I'll do it. And the second question is, how do you like it when the patient says, what would you do, doc, if you were me?
Okay.
These are fantastic questions, Janice. I will answer the second one first. When a patient asks me, what would you do if you were me, or if
I was your mother.
If your mother,
yeah.
Exactly. The thing to recognize is that we all have different values and preferences. So what I resist as a physician is the temptation of telling them what I would do for myself. And what I would then do is say, well, here are the issues I would consider. How are those for you? How important those are for you, and then help the patient in making a decision with me. I don't pretend that patients who are not interested, this is to your first question, who are not interested in making a decision, I don't have an agenda to force them to make a decision. I work with, I get in a dance with them where we go back and forth to see what are the issues that matter to them, and then we deliberate together and we make a decision together. I am yet to find a person that, with adequate support, says, absolutely, I will not tell you what I'm thinking. You tell me what to do with my body.
I think that's exactly right, and I think it is important to answer that question in context. For example, I always try to answer the question, but I say, here is my situation. You know, I have two young kids, and I have a wife, and I'm still responsible for them. And so if it were me, I would probably do this. But my situation is different than yours. But I do try to answer that question. I think it's only fair.
I think it's fair.
And also, if you present it as, here are your options, here are the pros and cons of each option, I mean, you are kind of leading the patient into that, whether they want to or not.
Yeah, and if a patient, after hearing that information, say, well, boy, that's very confusing, and I don't have a specific preference for one or the other, then I can begin to help them in terms of the direction they want to
follow. And the other part of her question was, what if someone says to you, I want you to make that decision for me? I think that's fair, too.
It is completely fair.
I think you explain to them what the options are, and I would recommend that you do this because.
Yeah, and I think then my job is much more difficult, because I want to then arrive at a decision, which will be her decision if she knew what I know. Mm-hmm. And that's very tough.
Back to the phones, 507-282-1234. Good morning, Barb. What's your question?
Hi, good morning. I do have a question to ask. You know, this sounds really, I like this concept. It sounds good on the radio and good on paper, but how receptive do you, I work in the medical field. Do you think your colleagues are real receptive to this new shared decision-making concept, so to speak? And also, is this a concept that's being taught to in medical school or to the residents coming through the ranks?
Is there shared decision-making 101, or is it minimally disruptive medicine 101? What are we talking about, medical school?
Barb, excellent questions. I'll answer the first one, not with my opinion, but with data. We've been working on this concept at Mayo for the last 10 years. And in all of our research, we've done several randomized trials, experiments, where we have some clinics do shared decision-making with some tools and support, and others not. And then we ask clinicians, doctors in general, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, mostly doctors, would you like to use these tools and this approach for the next time you want to make a decision like this? It has varied from study to study, but it's been between 70 and 95% of the doctors that say, I want to use this approach next time I have to make this decision. And a second point of evidence, when we've removed the tools from the field, we've had major requests to bring the tools back. Third point, when we've told clinicians, you can use the tools or you can give them to your diabetes educator, when we worked on diabetes, you can give these tools to your diabetes educator. You don't have to spend your time, which we know is precious, doing shared decision making with your doctor. Their diabetes educator can do it. Every time, we have had an exception to this, every time they said, no, I want to do this. So this is different from other things we ask doctors to do. This is something they actually want to do. They feel that they're trying to do, but they haven't had the support and tools to do it.
And is it being taught in medical school?
No. One of the frustrations I have is that we have not been able to explicitly address the skill sets that are needed for both patients and clinicians in any level of education, either medical school or nursing school or for health professionals or high school or college. college for people.
Yeah, well, sorry, Barb, did you have another comment?
No, that's okay. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks so much for your call. Can you give us a couple of examples in your experience where shared decision-making has made a real impact and you feel that it would indicate how important it is?
Yeah. The first one I want to give you is cholesterol-lowering medicines, statins. They're very popular. The guidelines that doctors have produced indicated that everyone with diabetes should take a cholesterol pill every day. Of course, everyone else should take a cholesterol pill every day. We developed a tool that shows for each individual person what their risk of a heart attack in the next 10 years is and how a cholesterol medicine can reduce that risk. It turns out when you look at it that way, most people that think of themselves as high risk are not as such high risk. And when you look at the benefit of the cholesterol medicine, the benefit is actually quite small in terms of reducing that risk, much smaller than what doctors and patients thought it was. So when you show it to people like this that who are low risk, we were able to show 70% reduction in the number of prescriptions for cholesterol medicine for people with diabetes who were actually at low risk. In other words, if they knew what we knew, they would have chosen not to take treatment. But the guidelines and our practice was to give them the medicine. So we've seen less exposure to drug, fewer patients taking many drugs in that way. And of course, the high-risk people were more likely to get medicine, which is exactly what you want to see. The second example, we just finished the recruiting for a study in which patients with depression were able to choose with their doctors the antidepressant that they would like to take to treat their depression.
And really?
Yeah. So what is interesting about it is, of course, most primary care doctors know one antidepressant, which is the one they prescribe,
sure.
And then they know the second one, the one they prescribe when the first one doesn't work. But there's like 20, and they have different side effects and things that patients, I think, have a chance to participate in the decision they have in this study.
All right. Probably everybody should be doing this, and I think physicians ought to be receptive to this concept of shared decision making. No question about it.
For our patients who are listening, they'll remember the three things. Ask what the options are, ask what the pros and cons of those options are, and then finally, how likely are some of those outcomes. Dr. Montori, thank you for being here today.
Delighted.
You'll come back again, I'm sure.
No choice.
All right. I think everybody's going to do this. From now on, Dr. Montori, you were fabulous. You're listening to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. You know, May is a lot of different things to a lot of different people, but it's also Stroke Awareness Month. We'll tell you about that coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back next week on Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio. We'll talk with neurologist and stroke expert Dr. Robert Brown. May, as I mentioned, is National Stroke Awareness Month, and with good reason. You know where it is on the list, Tracy, of the things that kill Americans? Not one, not two, not three.
Four.
Four, right. It used to be number three, but now that has been taken over by respiratory diseases, asthma, bronchitis, emphysema. It kills 150,000 people every year and leaves 250,000 handicapped. But the good news, 80% of strokes can be prevented. And that's what we want to learn about next week. And we'll tell you how they can actually stop a stroke. Now, you got to get to the hospital or you got to get someplace where they can help you. But even if you live in deepest, darkest Iowa, they can help you stop a stroke. And we'll tell you exactly how they remove a blood clot from the brain. It's pretty interesting stuff.
Your Iowa friends are not pleased right now.
Well, it's a great place. Now, you know they know I love Iowa.
That's where you come from.
Plus, we'll tell you about who is at risk for a stroke. And if you are at risk, what you should do to prevent it. We'll tell everybody how to prevent a stroke. All about stroke next week on Medical Edge Radio.
We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can also access a podcast of today's program and see that cute mole PSA for kids. Visit us at mayoclinic.com, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic share their expertise to empower you to better manage your health.
You've been listening to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Ron Petrovich, our associate producer, Audrey Castletine, our technical director, Andy Brownell. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.